Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 200 of Unblocking Crypto. How? Holy cow. 200 episodes. We made it.
Yeah, 200 seems like a lot since we do these once a week.
Yeah, so we're pretty much going on 4 years of this.
Yeah.
A lot's changed in 4 years. That's been an interesting ride, and it's, I feel like, just starting. So we're just scratching the surface at this point.
Yeah, I have the same feeling. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, are we really going to do another four-year cycle where October was the peak, then we're coming back down, and we're just in the same? Is it really the same thing again? And I mean, that's like 4 years ago. This is what we were talking about. That's like, holy crap. Here we go again.
Yeah. Well, before we jump into the Bitcoin, kind of some of the price stuff and what's happened here lately, the big thing that I saw, Texas, first U.S. state to buy Bitcoin for a strategic reserve. They acquired about $5 million at about $87,000 per Bitcoin. That's a big deal. Right? That's, we've been talking about this happening for a while, and I guess I'm kind of surprised that it happened this year at this point with everything going on.
Yeah, so I'm big on this when it comes to business, right? It's one thing to have a great business idea and get people excited and, oh yeah, this is a great idea. We'll come by, da, da, da. It's very different when it's like, okay, here's the bill. Pay me for the thing we talked about. Like, separating an organization or a person from their money is different. And so we've talked about all these states that have had all these different bills passed that are pro-Bitcoin, and they can keep confiscated Bitcoin, or they can get paid in their taxes in Bitcoin. But Texas is like the first one to actually cut a check and buy Bitcoin and have a cost basis of $87,000, which I think will show to be historically a good decision. So I think this is a big story of all of the state news that we were following. And we were, it was 2025, right? Where we were like, how many states will have Bitcoin adoption? And we were kind of counting them up, and then it kind of went cold.
Yep.
So to me, this is like everybody, a lot of states took the first step, which was passing some pro Bitcoin legislation. This to me is like the big second step where you actually start buying Bitcoin. Because that's when you actually pay attention to it. That, like, when you actually kind of feel a little pain and you separate yourself from some money and buy Bitcoin, now it's at 87,000. Okay, so let's hope and assume that this isn't a normal cycle and we're not going to go into a Bitcoin winter and, you know, the next 2 years are going to be kind of crummy. Let's go with like, hey, we're in a dip on a bull run and this thing's going to go to 120 again in 3 months. Texas is going to look good. They're going to be like, oh man, we should have bought more, right? Just like every person does the same exact thing. And then, so they'll slide in some more money. They'll find a little bit extra in the budget and allocate it to Bitcoin. So to me, this is a big deal. And it's the starting pistol for 49 other states that if this works out for Texas, then they need to make a decision.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like we thought New Hampshire or Arizona was going to be the first with them being into this so early, and now Texas has kind of leapfrogged everybody. So it'll be exciting to see. I'm intrigued to see if anybody follows quickly, right? Or I guess just with everything going on from a political point of view, is it's moving so slowly.
Right. I'm not optimistic about anything happening quickly. I'm not optimistic about anything happening between Thanksgiving and Christmas for government. So put that on the list of like why this is fairly exceptional. This occurred when basically half of the government's asleep and on vacation for the rest of the year. So I'll put this on something to put an asterisk by as potentially a kind of a turning point for state adoption.
Speaking of asleep, I mean, let's talk about Bitcoin for a second. It's yesterday had another 8% drop from what, 90 something K to 84 K, and I think it's back up to 87 or something like that. But there's a lot of worry about, oh yeah, this whole Bitcoin winter is coming. And if you look at liquidity on the order books, it's probably the thinnest it's been since like July. So it's like, no, everybody's kind of taken their Bitcoin, gone elsewhere, and not really paying attention, which means that because of that, you can move the price quite a bit with just a little bit of volume. And then there's a handful of other things going on. I think Yearn Finance had a little bit of a security issue with their YE pool, and some of that flooded into the Bitcoin space. And the Japanese government is talking about a bond yield hike or a possibility of that. So there's a lot of stuff going on right now, and everybody's been kind of hoping for the whole Santa Claus rally. And it's not looking like it's going to happen, at least not right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Bitcoin price dropped and kind of bounced off of 80,000 twice, which is bouncing off of 80,000 once is one thing. And bouncing off of twice, actually, not a bad thing. Hitting a double bottom and kind of establishing that floor. It kind of aligns with the bottom. We were in that trading range between 76,000 and 106,000, basically from November 24th or April of 25. And so if we're going to bounce around in there, that's fine. The 50 crossed the 200. So we had like a death cross in mid-November at about 92,000. The thing about it, when I was looking and thinking about that death cross issue, when the price is so stable for so long, the 200-day and the 50-day converge. And so it's not as bad as some of the previous death crosses when price is just ramping up and ramping up and ramping up and then stalls out and crashes. Because you just got the 200 day is mostly flat. So the 50 day, you know, if you've got a big volatility piece where you go from 120 to 90, you're going to cross, you know, over the course of 60 days. So I'm not, not every death cross is at the end of the world. I mean, a lot of times they dip down and then pop back up. It's not great from a technical analysis and all that stuff. And it's just boggles my mind because it's like, okay, yeah, okay, technical analysis. Let's read the charts and do like, you know, horoscopes for men and play all those games and laugh about it. But then you talk about all of the stuff that's going on. I mean, we're on the second day since they said that they were going to stop quantitative tightening. So there's that. We'll talk about a bunch of bullish news today. We've been talking about a bunch of bullish news every week, but not for 200 weeks, but definitely for like probably the last 70. You know, ever since the ETFs came out, it's been a lot of good news. And so to me, man, you know, if you just ignored everything that we pay attention to and you said, all right, the charts say this thing's going to drop to 60% decline off the top, you know, this thing's going to go to 55,000. Like, okay, that's what the cycles say. If this, you know, if adoption doesn't matter, if institutional adoption behaves the same as retail, then we're, you know, 55 is kind of the bottom. I'm like, I can't make myself think that that's true. I can't make myself think that we're going to see 55 again. And I can't think to myself that 125 is the peak and we're going to have 2 years under that. Because in no world where I had a spreadsheet and I was trying to figure out, you know, okay, do I want to peel off some Bitcoin and take some profits on my earliest stuff? In none of those scenarios did I ever sell at $126,000. Like, so, I mean, there's no action for me at these price levels. And so that I've got to be in some kind of cohort that's thinking similarly. And so maybe we just got through some of these early guys that wanted to sell as soon as, you know, around that six figure mark. But for a lot of people, like that got in the 2017 ramp, you know, you're in the whole thousands of dollars to maybe 10 to 20,000 of dollars in your first purchases. Selling at 100 is kind of like not good enough. You know, it's not a difference maker enough. If I'm in Bitcoin and I'm that early and I'm believe I'm right, I need to stick with it long enough for it to be a huge difference maker. Like I don't want to sell Amazon for a five bagger in 2008. You know, I'm going to hold on to it. So I think that's going to be the case for a lot of people. What do I know? All I do is just buy Bitcoin and not do anything else.
Well, we always joke about Bitcoin doing the opposite of what everybody else thinks. And I was looking at some of the options data last week. The long short ratio for Bitcoin on Binance climbed to 3.87, which is the highest level it's been in more than 3 years. Just over a month ago, when Bitcoin made their all-time high above that 126 number you were just talking about, that ratio was sitting at a multi-year low below like 0.6. So it just kind of goes to show that don't pay attention to what everybody else thinks is going to happen to Bitcoin. It's probably going to do the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why, you know, like last cycle, everybody was talking super cycle, escape velocity. Bitcoin's never coming down. We're going to six figures. Ah, blah, blah, blah. And what happened, right? FTX collapsed, We're at 16,000, you know, when everybody expects us to be at 100. And on this one, you know, it's like, oh, okay. Nobody's really talking about super cycle. We're talking about how weird this is that, you know, the cycle starts early. We got an all-time high before the halving. We like the ETFs are in and we've had these trading ranges and it's boring and volatility is down and we're not hitting a hyperbolic rise and all this other stuff. Like, I guess perhaps Bitcoin could just bounce around in the high five figures. I don't know. Well, like, where's the max pain? For a lot of people, it would be selling Bitcoin at 100,000 and then going to 200,000. Like, that would be psychologically brutal to think you're, I'm on top of the game. Oh, I did it right. It went down to 80,000. But once it gets to 55, I'm going to buy back. We're in a normal cycle. Never sees 55, only sees 200. Those people have to, you know, buy half of their Bitcoin back after paying taxes. So that'd be painful. So I don't know. The beauty of the Bitcoin strategy of just buy it and wait is that I'm like, I wasn't going to sell at 126. If it goes down more, I'll figure out a way to buy more. I'm kind of stuck. Like, I'm as allocated as I can be. I don't have a lot of dry powder left. So that's totally fine for me. And yeah, we'll just wait around and see what happens with price.
Well, let's talk about some of the stuff going on from a government perspective that is kind of interesting. And I know the SEC has been kind of active. They did just get a letter from the World Federation of Exchanges, which is pretty much this all what it sounds like, all the stock exchanges. They are urging the SEC to remove special exemptions given to the crypto firms offering tokenized stocks. And because they're worried that without proper safeguards, that there are some possible risks. And the whole reason this kind of came is I think the SEC talked about a potential sandbox framework that would grant time-limited exemptive relief to crypto platforms offering tokenized stocks, which is part of their broader effort to explore how digital asset markets might operate under modified regulatory conditions. So I think Paul is having a discussion maybe later this week to talk some more about some of this stuff. He hasn't really said what he's going to talk about, but I mean, to everybody else, this sounds like it's where the future should be going. And now all the exchanges are saying, whoa, wait a minute, we're not doing this. We need to stop the crypto firms from doing this and taking away all our business.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of like the inevitability of the disruption of various industries and different crypto. I mean, you can basically create a token that's designed to go after a market. And if you're in a situation where it's like all these IOUs are written, right, then you can basically eliminate all that and have something closer to a bearer asset representing the ownership of an equity or anything else. So there's going to be a pushback all the way up until the legacy companies have their solution based on the new rails. And then it's like, oh, back's over. Like, let's go. We've got our positions so that we're covered. And then they can tell the government officials that they sponsor that it's okay to go forward, and then they will.
Yeah, Caroline Pham, who's the acting chair for the CFTC, she also kind of came out and said they are looking for CEOs to bolster this newly formed CEO Innovation Council. The goal is to strengthen the agency's efforts as they expand its oversight of digital assets. So it continues to believe that it's going to get a lot more of the digital asset oversight. So I think they're soliciting nominations for this council due by the 8th of December. So we're a week away. So it'll be intriguing to see which CEOs become part of the CFTC's CEO council and where it goes from there, Tim.
Well, this is where I get cynical again, because it's government. We've been talking about the CFTC versus the SEC probably 3 years now. Mm-hmm. I think that was popping up when they were in the battle for the ETF approvals. And so we're 3 years deep in the conversation. And now the CFTC, which seems to be acting, or at least like this to me, like creating a CEO council is like, hey, you know what? I don't want to make a decision. Let's make something happen. Let's get some more people to talk. Like, talking looks like action. It's actually nothing, but at least we're doing something. Let's spend 3 months to accumulate some CEOs, get them in a room. They won't have a lot of free time, so it'll be super tough for us to have these calls. But it's not, we're not doing nothing. So look at us advance the ball. This, it just feels like, hey, let's create a meeting so we can plan on meeting again in the future. And not to be a total cynic, but I think I said it last week. I'm in total government sucks at everything mode again. And I'll put this on the list.
Yeah. So what we are seeing is kind of a big turnaround. And we've talked for a while about JP Morgan Chase and how at least Jamie Dimon is pretty much saying Bitcoin is kind of the rat poison squared, and Charlie Munger's words, right? Well, JP Morgan just came out with a very high stakes structured note that is tied to Bitcoin pretty much, right? It's going to offer a 16% fixed return if the targets aren't met. And then you have a potential for like a 1.5x upside by 2028 if Bitcoin surges. So it's really intriguing to me that all of a sudden JP Morgan, who said stay away from crypto, is now basing certain notes to Bitcoin and expecting the world to kind of jump in and almost giving them a you can't lose type of mentality with this.
Yeah, because I do think on the can't lose mentality, I think the downside risk is 30%. I think they capped the downside risk. So it is kind of like, hey, you want to have Bitcoin exposure? Here's some training wheels. We're JP Morgan. Let's put our brand on this Bitcoin package so that we can sell something and make a little money. This, I mean, I'll go ahead and blend this. I think it's great, right? Because this is opening, this is getting funds from people that aren't otherwise getting into Bitcoin. You're not self-custody, or maybe I'll buy this JP Morgan packaged product that is completely foreign to like the Bitcoin sovereignty and libertarian thing. It's more like centralized. They're taking care of everything. I'm just, you know, betting on Bitcoin going up. It falls in the same line as Vanguard allowing their customers to have ETF, Bitcoin spot ETF exposure. They said they never would. Vanguard, they were very adamant that this isn't what they do when the ETFs came out. And I think they lost some customers. They changed their CEO. They had a more crypto-friendly CEO come in. And now you've got, you know, I think today is the first day that Vanguard customers can purchase Bitcoin ETFs through their accounts. And so this is the Bitcoin is gunpowder adoption theory, where you're more than welcome to not adopt Bitcoin, but your competitors are, and they're going to destroy you. And so JP Morgan has to do it. Vanguard has to do it. So right in line with that, Bank of America and Merrill Lynch has now recommended 1% to 4% for their wealth customers. So 1% to 4% Bitcoin allocation from those guys. And so, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, the slippery slope of Bitcoin adoption. And when you when one organization or entity in an industry gets in, then everybody has to take a hard look at it. And when it works out for the first guy, there's more pressure for the second and third guy to jump in. And, you know, kind of here's where we are. I'm liking JP Morgan less and less as time goes on. And hopefully this does something good for Bitcoin and somehow blows up in their face.
Well, we can talk more about JP Morgan later. I guess it's interesting though, the Vanguard CEO, they hired from BlackRock, and he was the guy at BlackRock that was instrumental in getting BlackRock's Bitcoin fund going, right? So we kind of assumed at some point he was going to write the ship at Vanguard and teach them why they want to be involved in Bitcoin. A quick break from the podcast to talk about a little PDF I put together for everybody. I've been in crypto since about 2018 and made a lot of mistakes. And the one thing I always get asked is, what would you do differently if you got in today? So what I've done is created a PDF that talks about the 10 mistakes that I've made and how not to make those mistakes ever again. If you're interested, you can check the link in the show notes or go to www.jasonexplainscrypto.com/10 and get access to that PDF. That's the number 10 not spelled out. Back to the podcast.
But so, speaking of Bitcoin, the other big thing that I did see, Bitcoin had, Bitcoin Core, right, which is one of the most widely adopted and referenced clients in the Bitcoin network and protocol space. They had their first third-party security audit, which, I mean, it's a pretty big milestone for someone to do a third party rather than just doing it all internally. They didn't have any critical high or medium severity bugs discovered at all. They had two low severity issues and 13 other issues that are not classified as vulnerabilities. So it's,
I think exciting where we talk about things are transforming into something that is more easily accepted, and to see Bitcoin Core actually get a third party to audit what they're doing, that's exciting. It's the first time we've seen this, and I'm assuming we're going to start to see more of this, to where just the comfortability of everybody getting into Bitcoin is going to feel a lot better when you have these third party security audits happening.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't see the downside to having that performed on Bitcoin Core. It's when you look at institutional hesitations and things, it's like, well, they can just change the code, or they, you know, it's like, okay, well, do things like this and start to understand better that that's not how a consensus works, and the nodes versus mining process and all that. Like, go in there and really kind of go through it and check the code. And so I think I don't see the downside. I mean, it's just going to help more institutions convince people to get more Bitcoin exposure. And, you know, I think more Bitcoin exposure will kind of complete the lap for the store of value portion of money. And then once that's established, then we can really kind of kick off the medium of exchange portion. So the sooner we get through store of value, the better.
Yeah, some other big news too. So Polymarket is the world's largest crypto-based prediction market, right? We've talked about them in the past. They started in New York, were kicked out of the U.S. They just had, I think last week, the CFTC has issued the amended order of designation, which allows Polymarket to operate as a trading platform under the full set of federal rules for U.S. exchanges. So they're officially back. We've been talking about, they've been kind of in beta. Now they're good to go. In addition to that, their big competitor here is Kalshi, right? Back in April, Kalshi won this preliminary injunction stopping the Nevada gaming regulators from enforcing a cease and desist order against it. Well, the other day, the same judge that did that reversed himself and dissolved that injunction. So he now has sided with the Nevada Gaming Control Board and has said that Kalshi's event contracts on sports are just sports bets and require a Nevada gaming license. Apparently, election contracts fall under the same category. So now everything's back up in the air. Nevada can treat Kalshi like any other sports book and order them to stop offering sports contracts, or they can face some sort of enforcement, right? So what does all this mean? Now Kalshi has to either geofence Nevada or apply for a Nevada gaming license. So it's not too surprising. If you look at like companies like DraftKings and FanDuel, I think they're blocked in 10 to 15 states in the U.S. anyways. So kind of going back to, states can go and try different things. If that's what they want to do, then that's fine. Nevada apparently is going to block them. It'll probably get appealed again. So we're, 12 months away before the appeal goes through. So it's not really done yet. But the cool thing about Kalshi at the same time is, I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, is that Polymarket, everything was on-chain. Kalshi, everything was off-chain. Well, Kalshi just tapped Solana to move its prediction markets on-chain. So, I mean, that's kind of a big deal. Now we're seeing everything going to be on-chain, which I think will be better long-term. I think they have a little bit of probably some growing pains to figure out how to make that work. And Polymarket hasn't been perfect with everything on-chain. There's still been some problems, but it's better on-chain than some backdoor and centralized way of doing it all.
Yeah, so I got a couple thoughts about this. One, it kind of sucks for the prediction market companies that the mafia is not in charge of Las Vegas anymore, because I think they could just slip some money to the mafia and get these regulations resolved so that they can operate in Nevada. Unfortunately, now Vegas is run by private equity, and they don't play the game kind of like mafia does. So they are going to just fight them and push judges around and push regulators around and kind of protect the nest egg sort of thing. So Nevada sucks for Nevada. I think they'll probably be a tough hill to climb to get prediction markets open in Nevada, because there's too much. Well, again, until the private equity companies have their own portion investment in the prediction markets, and then they open it up because they'll have some of that revenue coming in. Vegas is actually having a lot of trouble right now since private equity has kind of taken over. They discontinued the subsidies for the flights to Vegas, so flying to Vegas is more expensive. They discontinued the subsidies for the hotels, and so the hotel rooms are expensive and the buffets are expensive, and all the stuff that used to just get people into Vegas so that they would spend money in the casinos. All of that stuff's kind of gone away. So it's changed the game. And I think that they're not seeing the returns that they thought they would. So I wouldn't be surprised if these same groups jump in and get a prediction market going or own portions of Kalshi or Polymarket, depending on how that goes. And then all of a sudden, Nevada will be open to them. Then the other thing that I wanted to talk about, Scott Melker mentioned this, is like Polymarket or the prediction markets in general are taking away the number one use case for all the crypto tokens, which is gambling. So the Polymarket could be the like small crypto killer. And now that people can just gamble on prediction markets and they don't have to pick some crazy meme token that's way down in 700,000th place on the coin market cap and gamble and hope that that comes up, they can actually just fairly legally gamble in prediction markets. And that kind of takes away the need to go through the trouble of trying to pump and dump various tokens. So I kind of like that idea because we haven't talked much about, oh man, look at some frog coin or some, you know, whatever coin that's shooting to the moon and 10,000% in a week. You know, we haven't talked about that in a long time. I'm sure it's happening, but it's not happening at the kind of scale that it used to. And there's a chance that the Polymarket and Kalshi is absorbing a lot of the funds that were flowing into those tiny cryptocurrency tokens. So those are my two thoughts on prediction markets this week.
Yeah, no, I think prediction markets are definitely changing the game. Robinhood, I think, is trying to expand their prediction market offering too. They just introduced a new futures and derivatives exchange through a joint venture with Susquehanna International Group, and they're expecting to begin the operations in 2026. So I think we talked about it last week. Coinbase wants to get in this, right? I mean, they're partnering with Kalshi on this. It's where everybody's going because that is going to be where you get a lot of people focused on. If they can do it all from an app on their phone, why do they need to go to Vegas?
And it's pretty funny that it took crypto and Bitcoin to bridge the gap between straight up gambling and guessing at what's going to happen in the future and buying stocks. Yeah. So like now you can, well, in 2026, you'll be able to straight up gamble, buy Bitcoin and crypto and buy equities all in the same app. Because it's pretty much the same stuff, and it's all driven by the debasement of the dollar or a currency, right? Everybody's forced to take higher risk to get higher return to keep up with inflation because they're getting eaten up and they're running out of time as far as converting their time into money. You can only work 24 hours a day, and you can't do that 2 days in a row. So you can't pick up a fourth job, so you kind of got to gamble to try to turn your money into more money so that you can maintain your lifestyle, and this is where you end up. And I think this is the modern equivalent of where previous civilizations have ended up when money starts to fall apart.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the stablecoin news. So I'm sure most people have probably heard of Klarna before. They're a Swedish fintech company. They have a lot of the buy now, pay later services. They just announced they're going to launch their own stablecoin. They're doing it on the layer one network Tempo, which we've talked about for quite a while here in the past few months. They're going to call it Klarna USD when it debuts next year. It's, of course, Stripe is the one that owns Tempo, so it's based on that. They are seeing stablecoins as a way to reduce cost dramatically for both consumers and merchants. What's interesting too, their CEO was once a very vocal crypto skeptic that he told CNBC that he was deeply worried about Bitcoin's promotion on social media and urged regulators to step in. So I feel like we hear this theme over and over again where somebody like Larry Fink hated Bitcoin, thought it was horrible, and now he's becoming kind of the chief marketing officer for Bitcoin. But they are apparently going to be the first bank to launch on Tempo, and they already have $27 trillion a year of transactions, and now they're bringing that onto their own stablecoin platform. So it'll be faster, cheaper cross-border payments for, I think they have 114 million customers. So it's wild. It's moving quickly.
Yeah, just my thoughts on him saying that he's concerned about Bitcoin's promotion on social media. There is no Bitcoin LLC or Bitcoin S Corp with a marketing department that does social media promotion. Social media promotion for Bitcoin is just people talking. It's regular people that own Bitcoin talking about Bitcoin. So if you're saying you're worried about the promotion of social media or the promotion of Bitcoin on social media, you're saying, hey, let's regulate people's ability to talk. That's not great. That's not a great position. It's a very not a great position if you're pro Bitcoin to be anti-free speech. So, you know, put this guy on the list of guys that maybe aren't looking out for the best interest of the collective and everyone, and maybe looking out for the best interest of themselves.
Sounds like he could have been the Democratic nomination for president here recently.
Yeah, it's crazy that a European sounds like a U.S. Democrat. That's who would have thought that those two ideologies are converging? And then also, who would have thought, oh, wait, if I do more research, I can gain more by moving my company onto these platforms and I can perform better, but it'll be under the guise of, look how much better it is for my customers and look how much better it is for vendors and we can reduce transaction costs. When honestly, it's just, we can shift transaction costs from the banks to me if I run the stablecoin. And then instead of paying 2.9% per transaction, I'll collect 0.9% per transaction and my entire business model flips and I do a lot better and the banks don't. So cool. I'm not saying I'm pro bank here and that banks should be collecting, but it's, you know, philanthropic, you know, mind change of people like this. They're like, oh no, maybe this is, it's usually based on self-interest. And so I would chalk that up for that. Cynical how this week across the board, but you know, when you say things like that regulators should cut down on the promotion of Bitcoin on social media, you're telling regulators to, you know, hey, they're saying things that they shouldn't say on online, make them stop. That's not a good thing.
So speaking of other banks playing in the stablecoin space, U.S. Bank just came out and said they are testing their own stablecoin on the Stellar blockchain. The U.S. Bank is the fifth largest bank with about $671 billion in assets under management. So yeah, it's interesting they're doing it. We had talked about a lot of these big banks kind of working together to create their own stablecoin, and now it seems to be they're splitting off and trying to find their own way of doing it. They don't want to share.
Yeah, you know, U.S. Bank is another bank. You know, the more I've talked about it for a long time. I'm looking forward to the day where, as much as I love self-custody of Bitcoin, it's not for everybody, and it's definitely not for everybody outside of the 10 to 15% of the U.S. population that's already adopted Bitcoin. So when banks like U.S. Bank and Bank of America and Wells Fargo have Bitcoin savings account, when you log into your bank, like that's where I think we need to be. So this U.S. Bank, we haven't ever really talked about U.S. Bank. The only thing my experience with U.S. Bank is I financed my Tesla through U.S. Bank at 0.9% and did it on a day when the price of the Tesla I bought was exactly the same as a Bitcoin and they were accepting Bitcoin as payments. And now Bitcoin's worth more and the Tesla's worth less. And I find it, so I effectively financed another Bitcoin by financing the Tesla instead of selling the Bitcoin. And that little piece of financial decision worked out for me, especially since I'm pretty convinced we're not going to see $55,000 Bitcoin again, and my purchase price is a touch under that. So, yeah, man, the banks have got to do something. Like, I think that there will be a need for banking. I'm, you know, hyper-Bitcoinization, everything denominated in Bitcoin and all that. I think that's so far away. I think it's a lot farther away than a lot of Bitcoiners think. I think that in the intermediary, you're going to have banks, you're going to have lending, you're going to have all of this stuff. The banks need to start getting involved. They need to start understanding it. And you know, like the Jamie Dimons and the, you know, U.S. banks and the Vanguards and everybody, you know, they're starting to kind of break that shell and start to figure out how their customers want Bitcoin. So they need to find ways to get into it. And you know, here you go.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not just banks too. Sony just announced that they're planning to bring their USD pegged stablecoin for in-game settlements, and they're going to launch it in early 2026. So it'll be used for payments across the gaming and anime ecosystem. And I mean, just another use case for stablecoins that is going to take a lot of money away from what the banks were already doing.
Yeah, and here's Sony. Yeah, you know, like kind of my end game for gaming is, why aren't you using in-game currencies? Why don't you just use tokens that have actual real life value? And then you can transfer, you can earn your in-game currencies, and then you can transfer them out on chain and then convert them into dollars or yen or whatever. I don't know why gaming has been slow to do this. Maybe there's some banking license that you need in order to do that. I don't see why. The crypto companies don't seem to need one. So why would the gaming companies? But Sony would be a big enough player to kind of pick up that load. I mean, the PlayStation ecosystem is huge, and there's a ton of money flowing through it. And I bet they're tired of paying banks 2.9% for all the transactions too. So, you know, go for it, Sony.
So let's talk about some of the ETFs real quick. Grayscale, of course, being in the news, they seem to be kind of one of the leaders in the space. I guess they get in first and then keep their rates pretty high. But their Chainlink ETF, I think, starts trading today. They had a Zcash trust that they're moving to an ETF here very shortly too. So, I mean, the Zcash thing has been kind of crazy here lately with everything going on. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And then I also saw that CoinShares, they pulled all their SEC filings for XRP, the Solana with staking, and the Litecoin ETFs. They're planning to wind down their leveraged Bitcoin futures ETF, and which seemed weird, although it sounds as if they are preparing for a public listing with Vine Hill Capital. So it'll be, I think, a $1.2 billion SPAC merger. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see as more of these companies get involved in the U.S. equities.
Yeah, you mentioned Grayscale. The one thing I saw is just a headline. I didn't dig into it because Grayscale's not one of those companies that I view as somebody I need to pay a lot of attention to. But they did predict that Bitcoin was going to go to an all-new high in 2026. So their view is, we're not going to have this crypto winter starting now. What do they know, right? They're just trying to sell more Bitcoin ETF, you know, packages and stuff like that so that they get more paid more. But, you know, you mentioned Grayscale, and that's what I saw. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the digital asset treasury companies. So Strategy had some news here recently. I think there's been a lot of worry their stock has been getting hammered because the Bitcoin price has been going down. They sold a bunch of their Class A common stocks shares and created a $1.44 billion reserve to really safeguard any future dividend and interest payments, which I think they said would last them at least 21 months. They'll probably add some more to it to try to get to 24 months. And at the same time with those shares, they also bought another 130 Bitcoin for about almost $12 million. So they now hold 650,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah, this is on my list. So, you know, Saylor's been putting orange dots on a chart every Sunday pretty much for the last few years. And they posted these, like, you know, what's, you know, how about a green dot? Everybody's speculating on what it was. And it was they basically sold stock to buy dollars. And in my mind, this is just a defensive position to keep the Ponzi schemers, where do the dividends get paid from? Where are they making these preferred payments from? And, you know, all this nonsense. It's like, okay, well, we're sitting on $1.44 billion. We've got 21 months of runway. We're not going out of business for 21 months, no matter what happens to Bitcoin price, because we don't have any debt, right? All the convertible debt that comes up in the next couple of years has effectively already been shorted. They are, like, those shares just transfer. So, hey, we're playing defense. In my head, you know, it's like, all right, this is not exactly MicroStrategy ethos of buy Bitcoin, never sell your Bitcoin, don't buy anything other than Bitcoin. You know, then they bought US dollars instead of Bitcoin. So the only reason for somebody like Michael Saylor to do that is because it's like, hey, we're getting news that investors are concerned that we're constantly having to sell stocks to generate cash to buy the preferreds, and that feels like a Ponzi scheme and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, okay, well, we'll just do it all at once. And 6 months from now, nobody will even remember that we sold stock to generate this cash. And I think that's the play. And then I'm like trying to steel man this move from a Bitcoin standpoint. Like, the only thing I can really come up with is there's a barbell investment theory where if you have Bitcoin and cash, it's a better investment than the stock market. Like if you're it's something crazy too. It's like if you're in cash but you have 5% Bitcoin, then you outperform the stock market over a long enough period. And at this point, his barbell is 650,000 Bitcoin and $1.4 billion in cash. I mean, that's basically his entire holding. And so his barbell theory, or his barbell investment theory here, is way loaded up on Bitcoin. I think he's in the $50 billion range. And then he's at $1.44 billion in cash. So I'd say as long as Bitcoin goes up, your strategy is doing fine. They had like a 30-minute call to announce that on Monday, and I listened to it. And it was interesting because they add these new Bitcoin financial metrics, and he added basically what Bitcoin's price appreciation has to do per year for them to break even, for them to go bankrupt, for the one that I like is what Bitcoin price appreciation has to do in order for them to outperform Bitcoin. And all of those numbers were super reasonable. I didn't write them down, but like Bitcoin has to tank for them to be in real trouble. Bitcoin has to basically break even for them to appreciate versus the dollar. And Bitcoin only has to do like 12% per year for them to outperform Bitcoin. And so it's kind of like they're coming out with new stuff. They're coming out with neat stuff. They're trying new things. I own MicroStrategy. I'm not selling MicroStrategy. I still call it MicroStrategy. And maybe this works, maybe it doesn't. But for the next 21 months, it doesn't seem like they're going to go out of business. So that's a pretty long runway in today's equity investment.
Yeah, the number I saw is that Bitcoin needs to hit 12,700 for MicroStrategy to need to sell some Bitcoin from a solvency risk issue. Which
12,600, there's a lot of people in trouble because a lot of people have used these lending platforms to put Bitcoin up to get more cash to buy more Bitcoin, and they are liquidated way before 12,000.
And then they also saw Strategy updated their guidance on where the year-end price range for Bitcoin is going to be with everything going on. So their year-end price range they updated to 85,000 to 110, right? So pretty reasonable considered where everything is right now. But with that scenario, their operating income ranges from a $7 billion loss to a $9.5 billion profit, which, I mean, is a pretty big range. Kind of what you just talked about, the cash they have is $1.5 billion, right? Which is nothing compared to potential profit that it could be if just Bitcoin goes to, what, 100K. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not worried. I'm kind of the same boat as you. I think Strategy long-term is going to be great. It sucks with the price of Bitcoin, what it's done to everything, but even their market cap for Strategy is less than the market cap of the Bitcoin they hold right now, which is, it's just crazy.
Yeah. And another thing that I do with Strategy is like, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. And for all I know, having a $1.4 billion in cash on your balance sheet helps you get into the S&P 500, which is something that they've been passed up on for a few quarters now, including this upcoming quarter. So maybe this is a play to generate more passive income in the future by getting into the S&P 500. I don't know that that's true, but perhaps it's a game that he's playing in order to kind of help his position there. There's so many games to be played. I'm not going to pretend to know. Does holding cash make sense to me? No, I try not to hold any extra cash because it sucks, but I'm not playing the same games as a public company that's trying to get into or stay into being included in different index funds. So what do I know? But I know having 21 months worth of cash on your hands is better than having zero. If you're being looked at as an equity or an investment person, investment vehicle.
Yeah, you talked about taking out loans on your Bitcoin. So Metaplanet, which is, I guess they want to be the number two Bitcoin treasury company behind Strategy, right? They just announced they're going to take out $130 million loan using their Bitcoin as collateral. So they currently hold just under 31,000 Bitcoin, worth about 2.7 billion. Their goal though is to almost 7x that. They want to have 210,000 Bitcoin, which is about 1% of the overall supply by 2027, which is aggressive. I don't know how they get there that quickly, but yeah, I guess they're trying new things, taking out a loan, seeing if that works.
Well, I mean, when Bitcoin's price is 85,000, it's easier to collect more Bitcoin than it is when it's 120,000. So they could see this as an opportunity right now. The one headline I did see that is not great for Metaplanet in my mind is that Japan is going to cut their Bitcoin and crypto tax to 20% from, I think it was 55% on the gains from Bitcoin and crypto. So they're basically treating it more like an equity. And that tax arbitrage game that Metaplanet was playing might be coming to an end in Japan. So that's worth keeping an eye on too.
Yeah, and that's supposed to be finalized by the end of this year. So it goes into effect for next year. So that'll be interesting to see if that does actually happen. To me, that seems quick, but it definitely is possible for it to happen.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, just stuff to keep your eye on. And while we're talking about these Bitcoin treasury companies, you know, you got the Nakamoto's and the 21, the Jack Mallers, SoftBank, Cantor Fitzgerald vehicle. The government shutdown basically stopped the process for getting those things approved and getting through the SEC in order to merge and SPAC or do whatever they got to do to get their new USIP codes on the stock market so they can generate funds so they can buy Bitcoin. So kind of working in their favor because Bitcoin's price was like 110, 120, and then Bitcoin's price is down. So I assume that this thing's thawed out. Maybe they can get something done and push things across over the next month or two, and they can start to fund their Bitcoin treasury companies with less expensive Bitcoin than they would have if they would have done it earlier.
Yeah. Well, the other one, Bitmine, which is pretty much the largest Ethereum treasury company, and actually it's probably the second largest treasury company outside of Strategy, they just acquired another almost 97,000 Ethereum last week. So they now hold around 3.73 million Ethereum. I think they have about $4 billion in unrealized losses. So they're still buying more. They see this as just one of those low points and things are going to get better in the near future. But it's crazy. I mean, they're over 3% of the Ethereum supply. I think their goal is to get to 5%. So just talk about conviction. Holy cow.
Well, when you make the decision that you're in accumulation mode and the price goes down, it's great. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to a point where you're like, man, I'm kind of tapped out here. I'm just going to ride this out. And the price goes down. You're like, God dang it. So, yeah, I mean, they're probably loving some price dip.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the international news. Upbit was in the news. So Naver Financial is apparently planning on acquiring Dynamu, which is the operator of Upbit, about almost a $10.3 billion all-stock deal. That means Dynamu's leaders will be the largest shareholders in Naver. The merger is going to keep both companies, their businesses running while they kind of explore the restructuring and jointly pursue growth. I think they're both looking at stablecoin initiatives too. We're now waiting for South Korea's, their Fair Trade Commission, to approve that. And during all of this, Upbit had a security incident where I think they lost about $36 million. A lot of it had to do with the Solana network. It looks like there was a bunch of irregular transfers that were happening on a handful of some of the Solana meme coins. So they moved the remaining funds offline and put freezes on everything. It looks like the Lazarus group is the one that kind of did that, the North Korean group. So they are planning to fully reimburse all their customers with $36 million, I guess, if they're getting a deal of $10+ billion, they can afford $36 million to make everything right. So yeah, that was interesting to see.
Yeah, it comes to no surprise this story is not on my radar, so I don't have much to add on that.
Well, the other thing, when we talk about South Korea being kind of this pro crypto side of things, it's interesting to see more stuff happening in the South Korea space because it's been a while since we've been talking about them on the positive side. I did see something on the negative side. There were a couple of South Korean police officers that were indicted for allegedly taking bribes from the operators of illegal crypto exchanges. It ended up being tied to about $168 million of voice phishing laundering operations. So those two guys, I want to say they got paid like $7,000 or $8,000 equivalent to US and $2,000. But now the authorities have frozen $1 million in assets and they're doing this broader probe and yada, yada, yada. What was interesting is one of the South Korean CTOs kind of made a comment that the larger threat that he sees is that governments are committed to this. Governments are worried that the public's committed to this privacy and self-custody wallets, which is kind of why governments have gone after all these Mixer developments, which is, I think we've kind of been talking about that for a while. And Switzerland just had another Mixer that the European authorities dismantled because they're saying it had laundered over $1.4 billion in Bitcoin since 2026. And they seized all the data and the servers and $27 million in crypto. So although it's probably kind of a short-term thing because most of these Mixers, they start in one place and when they get shut down, someone just pops it up in a different place and they move to that.
Yeah, it's super convenient that governments can find all these evildoers and then they can use that to say you shouldn't have privacy. No one should have privacy. We can't allow that, so that, you know, 0.01% of the population can't do something. We need 100% of the population. We need to know everything they do. I'm not a fan.
We haven't talked about China in a while. China kind of was going ping pong back and forth on crypto for a little bit, but the People's Bank of China, I just pretty much made it pretty clear. They just warned that virtual currencies, including stablecoins, do not have the same legal status as legal tender and cannot be used as currency in the market. So virtual currency-related business activities constitute illegal financial activities. So I guess China's back to crypto is bad.
Okay. Like, it won't be long. They'll loosen up something somewhere. So, you know, they are very tight on their capital flight coming out of China, and they're pretty protective of it. So that wouldn't be too big of a surprise.
Visa just announced they partnered with one of the crypto infrastructure companies, AquaNow. The reason they're doing this is they're bringing stablecoin settlement capabilities to Central and Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. So, I think it's about time that Visa gets more involved in the stablecoin side of things. I think their settlement volume has reached about $2.5 billion as an annualized run rate, which is tiny compared to what they're doing from a cash business.
Yeah, I'm surprised we don't hear more about Visa and well, you know, MasterCard's kind of been a little bit ahead of them, but I still haven't seen anything that impacts me on any sort of day-to-day operations or anything. So they at least they're doing something, because they're going to get rocked if Bitcoin Lightning type of layer two stuff happens and then the transactions start to flow. Stablecoins have got to be eating them up a little bit already, so they got to do something.
Hey, speaking of MasterCard, Kraken just launched a Bitcoin rewards card called the Crack Card. It's a MasterCard powered debit card. It's going to roll out to users in the UK and the EU, although they expect to expand that to other geographies in the coming weeks, apparently. I looked at it a little bit. It's like 1% back on all your transactions. I think there's going to be some other benefits, and it's going to be tied into their payments app, Crack. But I mean, shoot, with the Gemini card, they seem to be way ahead of what Kraken's doing with their card. So I'll be intrigued to see how things roll out and when it gets to the US, what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like these credit cards are slow to come out. Like, we've been talking Fold Card. We've been talking about this stuff for a long time. It doesn't seem that freaking hard to me. Like, every airline has its own credit card. Every Macy's, every Kohl's card. I mean, like, everybody's got a credit card. But Bitcoin and cryptos really seem to struggle to get a Bitcoin or crypto rewards card going. That's kind of decent or popular or whatever. So, like, these debit cards must be easier to get through regulations than credit cards. I don't know what the deal is, but like, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. El Salvador was in the news here recently again too. I think they just had a conference down there, but they announced that Simple Proof, which is the Bitcoin based document timestamping company, has partnered with two of El Salvador's government groups, so the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Environment, and the goal being to protect their government records using the Bitcoin blockchain technology. So now they're both ministries are going to register their official documents on the Bitcoin blockchain. The verified records are publicly accessible through dedicated government portals. And what they pretty much came out and said is Bitcoin is not just digital money. It's also a clock that no one controls and allows us to certify with precision the exact moment a document was created, guaranteeing its authenticity and protecting the country's history forever. We're helping ensure that the country's history is preserved intact and can be verified directly on Bitcoin without intermediaries. So that's pretty interesting. I guess I didn't really know too much about Simple Proof, but they have a couple of previous programs, one being here in Georgia in Screven County. And the other one was in Guatemala, where I think Guatemala used it for some of their 2023 elections. But the one in Georgia back in November of 24, they were the first U.S. county to secure its election results on the Bitcoin blockchain. And if you want to go back and look, it's blockchain 869047. So to me, this definitely would be awesome to see. I've looked at my voting record according to DeKalb County, and it's all wrong. So I wish we had more things that were actually accurate and you could verify the timestamp of when I voted and show where it was. But I think we're still a little ways away before that happens around the world.
Yeah, I listened to this guy talk about the Guatemalan election in a podcast a few years ago. And, you know, it just comes down to politicians don't want elections to be secure and accurate. So I don't think it's going to happen. So I wish it would, because you're right. Voting records are wrong. Who knows what's going on? Something like 35 to 50 million illegal immigrants are in the country. They're using social security numbers for work. They could easily be using those to vote. So clean it up and then see what happens. But I don't think there's enough desire to clean it up at the time.
So I can't say their name. Kyrgyzstan, one of the stans over there, they have officially launched their USDKG, which is a gold-backed stablecoin pegged one-to-one to the US dollar. Initial issue has $50 million. It is issued on Tron. It's fully audited by the Consensus Diligence. And they do have some future expansion slated to include Ethereum. So interesting to see other countries doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll see it. And I think this kind of falls into the note that I had, that Tether bought more gold than any central bank last week. And I suppose you could say that the Tether is at least partially gold-backed in addition to treasuries and Bitcoin now. But these companies are finding ways to bolster themselves and keep their stablecoin pegged at a dollar. And other countries can do that. Other companies can do that. And I think if I were a country or a company, I think I would probably just use Tether and not have to deal with it.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw the news that the S&P downgraded Tether to a 5 out of 5 from a stablecoin perspective. And their CEO kind of fired back that it was the agency is just a propaganda machine at this point.
Yeah.
They apparently said that Tether's reserves were high risk because their Bitcoin now represented like 5.6% of the USDT in circulation, which exceeded the 3.9% over-collateralization margin. And they're saying that the reserve can no longer fully absorb a decline in its value. So it's kind of a mess. What's going on? If you look at Tether, I think they're based in El Salvador. They do quarterly attestations from the audit firm BDO Italian. They had $181.2 billion in assets with $174.4 billion in circulating USDD as of the last audit. So they were
Run those numbers by me again on collateral versus circulation.
So they had $181 billion in assets and $174 billion in circulating Tether.
Okay, exactly, right? Bitcoin's down 30%, and they're still over-collateralized. And the agency's just like, oh, well, their Bitcoin, you know, this is for... If their Bitcoin goes to zero, I still think they have enough treasuries and gold to cover their assets or cover the circulating Tether with their assets that are back it. So just because they hold Bitcoin, they're basically they buy Bitcoin with their profit. They don't buy Bitcoin to support the circulating Tether. So what's the point? He's right. It's just a marketing machine that doesn't make any sense. I mean, Tether would be better off if they held U.S. dollars with their profit and had like an old school treasury process as opposed to having Bitcoin. It's just dumb, right? They have $7 billion to play with between their assets and what they have to back in circulation. So they get downgraded. So that's brilliant, right? It's just so frustrating, man. Like their 3-month treasury bills are covering their assets, And then they're just buying whatever they want to buy with the profit they can buy, right? They'd be, honestly, that agency would probably prefer if they just spent it on hiring new random people they don't need to run the business. All right, ran over.
You're not wrong. Yep. Australia was in the news here recently too. You're actually starting to see Australia wake up to them being behind. So the Treasurer and the Financial Services Minister introduced a bill to Parliament on Wednesday that has kind of targeted some of the regulatory gaps that have left apparently billions of client assets unprotected. It's going to create two new financial product categories, digital asset platforms and tokenized custody platforms, which will require Australian financial services licenses, although those platforms holding less than 5,000 per customer and facilitating under 10 million annually are exempt from the licensing requirements. So they're trying to get, I guess, more relevant, but man, they got a long ways to go.
Yeah. I mean, it's everybody's got a long way to go. I mean, you gotta do what you gotta do. These, I don't know. It would be nice if we were in this bullish price signal for all of this, all these actions, but right now we're kind of in the, I mean, to me, if this is as bad as it gets, then we're doing great. On the next, you know, you got kind of a short period of time here to catch the next bull run, because then right now it's tough to get investment. When we get back over 100,000, the investment, that money starts flowing again. So you can position yourself right now.
Speaking of a long way to go, UK was in the news too. Their chancellor of the executor, I'm not even sure what it is, did not raise taxes on crypto in their latest budget statement. They did say the path towards tighter regulation and greater tax transparency is well underway. So a lot of the industry figures welcome some of the pro-entrepreneur measures, but warn that the broader tax and regulatory pressures risk undermining some of the UK competitiveness in fintechs and digital assets. And I think that one comment that I saw that made me laugh was, a rainy island with a hostile tax system is a hard sell. It's kind of what the UK is becoming.
Yeah, I've pretty much written the UK off, man. They arrested a guy. He came to the United States. He was shooting some firearm at some shooting range, like perfectly fine. Hundreds of millions of people do this every year. Posted it in social media, came home to the UK, got arrested. So the UK is in trouble. If they could do whatever they could do to keep crypto, Bitcoin from not being suppressed, maybe that's an option for people that live in the country to kind of help preserve some freedoms, but they're in trouble, man.
Yeah. Thailand was in the news. We haven't really talked about WorldCoin in a while, but the data authorities in Thailand ordered that World, which is Sam Altman's iris scanning operation, delete over $1.2 million records that they've collected in the country. Apparently, the expert panel over there investigated whether World had breached the country's Data Protection Act and concluded that collecting biometric data in exchange for cryptocurrency was a violation of the law. So, yeah, no surprise there. They're one of the many countries doing that. I think Germany just did something like that here recently, too. So it's becoming the norm.
Well, I mean, if your government has to protect you from having your iris scanned in exchange for cryptocurrency, your population's in trouble. There's over a million people that traded their iris biometric data for basically nothing.
And $30.
For $30 in cryptocurrency that might only be worth $5 now. Who knows? Like people are in trouble. Like educating people is hard, but it's super important. So companies like WorldCoin may just go attack like the least sophisticated countries first and build a huge database for cheap. So we'll see. Personally, I would not advise giving Sam Altman your biometric data. That seems like a bad idea to give to the like one of the leading AI companies, and specifically a guy who has no problem doing some super unscrupulous business practices and taking a nonprofit to profit and kind of screwing over a lot of investors. So keep your biometric data as personal as you can for as long as you can.
I would say keep all your data personal. Don't give him anything, but that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Canada was in the news. So I know we've been talking about rent attacks, but there was a sentencing decision, I think last week, that revealed some of the details of this. And the attack happened back in like 2024. The victims were like bound, waterboarded, and sexually assaulted. The goal was to steal the family's Bitcoin holdings. It was wild. I think they still made off with like $1.6 million. They caught maybe four of them, but at least one of them just got sentenced. He pleaded guilty to breaking and entering, unlawfully confining the victims, and sexual assault.
and he got 7 years in jail. So kind of
frustrating. 7 years. 7 years is not a lot for what amounts to kidnapping and sexual assault. That's like, that's a light term.
Yeah. I mean, you think about what Doquan, who we haven't talked about in a while, I think he's in the U.S. now, getting about to be sentenced. They were saying the max they would give him is 12 years, and his lawyers were asking for 5. Although I think he's still wanted in South Korea, and they want to give him at least 40. So these places are finding locations that are willing to say, all right, yeah, maybe 5-7 years, you'll be a changed person, and I'm sure you won't do the same thing ever again.
Yeah, that's wild, man. I mean, it's, to me, I mean, even CZ with Binance got like a pretty hefty jail term. He didn't actually, all he did was not put in systems that were in line with know your customer requirements. Like, he didn't kidnap and sexually assault anybody. So
yeah,
like, whatever, man. The justice system is sliding into a not a good place.
Well, Russia was in the news too. There was a Russian man that apparently stormed a St. Petersburg-based crypto exchange armed with weapons. He was 21 years old. He apparently detonated 2 airsoft grenades and set off a smoke bomb before ordering the staff to transfer all the available crypto to his wallet, which to me just seems hilarious that that's happening. I mean, one, an airsoft grenade isn't really going to do much, and a smoke bomb's not going to do much other than scare people, but it's like, yeah, all right, scan my QR code and put it into my wallet. I think we're going to be able to track that pretty easily if that happens. I don't know what he was thinking.
I mean, that doesn't feel like the actions of a 21-year-old. Like, a 10-year-old would think maybe, ooh, these airsoft grenades and smoke bomb will get them. Like, by the time you're 21 years old, you ought to be like, this is not a good plan. This is probably not going to work, but it's probably going to give me a ton of trouble. So yeah, I guess good that he didn't take things more seriously and people got hurt or whatever, but like, weird plan for a 21-year-old. I mean, that's 3 years of being an adult, and that's your plan to steal crypto. Like, better, I'm not saying kidnap and sexually assault anybody, but like, I mean, an airsoft grenade hurts a little. Well, that's not going to, if that's all you got, why would anybody give you anything? Like, okay, man. Like, now we're just in a fist fight, I guess.
Yep.
People are weird, man. Like, here's the thing. Just go work and start a business. I mean, I know Russia is probably tougher to do that than what I'm used to in America, but like, you don't have to do this stuff. You don't have to, like, you can come up with better ways to accomplish things, and then you can buy your own Bitcoin with money that you earn the right way. And then, you know, you can actually have a story to tell instead of living like this, man. It's weird.
I know we've been talking a lot about gold versus Bitcoin in the past few weeks. And there was Nick Szabo, who was the creator of one of the cryptocurrencies before that I think Bitcoin kind of relied on. There was a lot of question on whether or not he was Satoshi at one point too. But the question that he kind of weighed in on was, if gold was so perfect, why did it lose its monetary role? And his point was that it was pretty straightforward. He said gold did not fail because people stopped valuing it, but it failed as money because centralization broke it. Once the metal was locked away in bank vaults and the whole system relied on trust and custody, the door opened for abuse. And he went on to explain that gold's main weakness was its poor resistance to theft, and moving large amounts of gold was tricky, slow, and risky. So bills of exchange were used to make high value transfers, and then Telegraph made the change even faster. Merchants liked how quick it was to settle payments remotely instead of risking shipping metal across borders. So one of the big reasons why Bitcoin is making it so much easier is you don't have to worry about the centralization piece, and it, the whole trust and custody, it happens on a ledger that nobody owns. So it was, I guess, good to hear, right? Nothing new, I think, for you and I to hear, but it was just a great way of explaining it.
Yeah, and I think like I like that explanation greater than the simplicity of digital gold. Explaining like, hey, yeah, gold is great. Gold works. Gold's great for monetary data. All the way up until you need to cut it up into small pieces for small transactions, or you need to transact with somebody far away. So to me, you can explain, if somebody is a gold bug, you can explain Bitcoin as filling the gaps that gold hasn't been able to accomplish. So I've listened to Nick Zorbo quite a bit over the years. He's been doing this for a long time. So
smart guy.
I agree.
I know you're not paying too much attention to it, but tomorrow Ethereum is going to have a network upgrade. The Fusaka hard fork is scheduled. If you look at Fusaka, kind of the big thing is the peer DAS, which is the data availability sampling that Vitalik has previously described as the key to Ethereum scaling. So whether or not that's true, I don't know. I know they've changed the gas limit. They raised it about 33% from where it was. And if you look at what the scaling networks have reached at Ethereum, I think the past 24 hours had done like 31,000 TPS, which is pretty freaking good. Now that's across all the networks, not on Ethereum's L1. But yeah, intrigued to see how the upgrade goes. And I mean, Tom Lee's bought in. So we'll hopefully this will continue to move forward positively for Ethereum as well.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not paying attention to that. I did not know that they were having an upgrade. And I hope it doesn't crash everything, and I hope everything works out fine.
I think they've already tested it all out. So it's not like they just flip a switch and see what happens.
But I mean, they're also daisy chaining upgrade after upgrade after upgrade. And when you stress test, as big as Ethereum is and as often as it's used for all these different things, they can't stress test every single vector. So we'll see. It's fine. I'm not being a jerk about it. I genuinely hope we don't have like an Ethereum crash or some kind of major bug problem. So hopefully all of those days are behind us.
Had a couple of things on some of the real world assets. So Fidelity has their tokenized money market fund, which is all on Ethereum. It just passed $250 million on chain about 4 months after debut. It's up 15% from 30 days ago. So, I mean, good news from the RWA space. What's interesting is the big competitor to that is BlackRock's Buildle, right? But it's, instead of $250 million on chain, it has like $2.3 billion in assets. So it is a much larger product than what Fidelity is, and Fidelity has a long ways to go. Armundi, which is Europe's largest asset manager, I think they have like $2.3 trillion in assets under management. They just announced they're going to launch the first tokenized shares of one of its money market funds. So I'll be intrigued to see how big that fund becomes and how much of it is money market. I mean, you look at BlackRock, and BlackRock's is what, 1% of Amundi's total assets. So yeah, be interesting to see how quickly that grows.
Yeah. And I mean, if the European version grows and it shows that it's awesome, then I'm sure BlackRock will pull a lever and become the biggest in the world pretty quickly. They tend to just do that. And yeah, some of this stuff's going to work, man. So they need to just start trying it.
Zcash had a tough week. They dropped about 50% from their high. That was after about a 700% price increase. What's crazy is there's a few people that came out and talked about it and said the market cap for Zcash is still about 20 times smaller than XRP. And the privacy narrative is really why people wanted crypto in the first place. So they think Zcash is going to continue to grow and probably catch something like XRP, which I think you and I have argued, still not 100% sure what the use case is for XRP at the end of the day. If XRP is at X and Zcash is 1/20th of that, I guess it makes sense. They should be able to get up to close to that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Zcash privacy narrative is great for people that really are willing to put in effort for privacy. I think the problem is the vast majority of human beings they're not willing to do 1% extra effort to gain privacy. So whatever these available market estimates are, I think they need to be discounted. And the same with XRP. I mean, yeah, the total available market may be through the roof, but what is actually obtainable, you know, as stable coins are basically attacking the same available market. To me, you got to be careful about these. It just reminds me of like when an investor or a founder comes in with a slide deck. That's what they got. They don't have a business. They don't have a product. They don't have a team. They got one guy with a slide deck and an idea. And I just feel like XRP is still kind of at that level. And look at the total available market. If we actually succeed, $20 trillion or whatever. It's like, Yeah, okay, but that available market is moving, right? And stablecoins are eroding that available market. And, you know, if you have a group full of people who are huge on privacy, then Zcash's available market looks huge. But if you actually are like, hey, no one cares about privacy when you get out beyond the, you know, the top 3% of the population that cares about privacy, the bottom 97%, it's, we know, don't care. Like, we can tell they don't care because look at the internet and look at the passwords and look at, you know, nobody's even willing to go beyond password 123. You know, like, they have to put all these password challenges so that you can't just put in 123456789 every time you have your password. People don't care. They don't want to. So whatever, man, it's a good idea. And people are passionate about their ideas. And then they take that passion and they convert it into total available markets that are unrealistic.
Yeah. I also saw there are some interesting things where, I mean, talking about people don't care, right? So Solana, there's a Chrome extension called Crypto Copilot. They apparently, that extension has secretly added a hidden Solana transfer to every Radium swap. So it's siphoning off fees to the attacker's wallet. The security platform Socket found that the extension used some obfuscated code and a misspelled inactive backend to mask its activity. What's crazy about this, I mean, granted, the theft is pretty small. I think it does scale with the trade size, right? But the extension is still live on the Chrome Web Store right now. So, yeah, be careful about using extensions that aren't vetted. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really focused on privacy. So focused that I downloaded an extension on my browser and I'm using that for financial transactions. Mm-hmm. Like, yep, people really give a crap and are willing to do it. Now, no, oh, I can just download this extension. It makes my life easier. Okay, click, 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 boom, done. That's it. That's all. That's what crypto's up against pretty much all the time. I mean, that's why Bitcoin's adoption is slow, because it's right now it's more difficult, right? Using dollars and credit cards and all that's easy. Why? Because the banks do all the work, and using cash is more difficult. Why? Because you have to keep up with it. You can't lose your wallet. You can't leave your cash on the counter or anywhere, or it's gone. Oops, I lost my wallet. Man, now I got to go through the hassle of calling my credit card company to protect all my assets or spendable limits. Like, that's a huge benefit that the credit cards provide, so that people don't have to actually do the work of keeping up with their stuff. Like, people are lazy and soft, and that's the biggest problem that Bitcoin has. And it's up against the laziness and the just the lack of effort that human beings want to put into protecting themselves. So, you know, good luck to the other organizations out there.
I'm not sure that's going to change anytime soon, unfortunately.
But it's only getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah. So another company we haven't really talked much about is Exodus. And for a lot of people that have been around for a while, I mean, they're one of the self-custody wallet companies that have been here almost since the beginning.
Yeah.
They just agreed to acquire W3C Corp and its subsidiaries, which Banks is one of those. I think it's about $175 million they're going to be paying. And what this will do is really allow their expansion into the crypto payments infrastructure. So I think the way I understood it is that they would have the ability to build an end-to-end payment stack from wallets to cards, which would be great, right? Their transaction is expected to close in 2026. So I'll be intrigued to see what happens when that closes and what they do with it.
Yeah, I'll pay attention to that. Exodus Wallet is actually kind of like a old school Bitcoin mentality. I'm kind of curious what they do.
Yeah. So speaking of that, one of the things that they use in the Exodus Wallet is Shapeshift, right? One of their head of marketing for Shapeshift, Houston Morgan, pretty much just came out and told the Block that JP Morgan Chase has abruptly closed his business account last Friday and informed that his personal account will be closed this week as well. When he reached out to Chase to find out what was going on, he was told they were discontinuing business with him in order to protect the financial institution of Chase. So once again, you're hearing about debanking, shocker, with JP Morgan Chase, right? And in addition to that, you just had the Republicans and the House Financial Services Committee released a 53-page report on Monday titled Operation Chokepoint 2.0, Biden's debanking of digital assets. So I don't think it's gone away, right? We've been talking about hopefully it was going to happen and it was going to end, but it seems like it's still not ended yet.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Jack Mallers having the same problem with JP Morgan. I mean, it's everything's fine. You're doing business. Everything's going along smoothly. And then bang, they close your account. So I don't know, man. 2.3.0, I guess, is kind of around the corner.
Yeah. And then the last thing that I had was kind of interesting. It was related to David Sacks, right? And so David Sacks has kind of been targeted by the New York Times a little bit. So he kind of came out and publicly challenged a New York Times investigation onto his conduct as White House AI and crypto czar. And he argued that the paper spent months pursuing allegations that lacked evidence. So he posted on X on Sunday. He claimed that five New York Times reporters were assigned over the summer to find a conflict of interest tied to his government role and his background in the technology sector. They, through these series of fact checks, they revealed their accusations, which they debunked in detail. I think they even wrote an article called Silicon Valley's Man in the White House is Benefiting Himself and His Friends, and that he used this dual role in the White House and a major investor to advance policies that could benefit his own extensive AI and crypto-related holdings and those of his associates in Silicon Valley. So he said the New York Times repeatedly pivoted to new theories as earlier ones were disproven, and every time we would prove an accusation false, New York Times pivoted to the next allegation. So he said this process has lasted 5 months and arguing that the resulting story amounted to a nothing burger. So I think what I saw is that it's, I think they argued it was called the reckless disregard for the truth or subjective knowledge of falsity. So he posted this letter to Twitter and everybody can go read it and find out how they willfully mischaracterized or ignored the facts. So no surprise there, I guess, from the media.
Yeah, I mean, David Sacks is not the, it's not the, if you want to find people using their positions in government to make themselves and their friends richer, David Sacks is not your guy. I mean, he sold pretty much everything he's got when he jumped into his role as the AI crypto czar. Is it enriching his friends? Yeah, it's also enriching the people he's never met before because he's helping the innovation of crypto and AI move forward. That's his job. It's kind of dumb. You, in order to hire someone to take AI and crypto forward and kind of pave the way for them within government, you're saying that you need to hire someone that has no idea about AI and crypto and has no connections with anybody that has any connections to AI and crypto. And guess how successful that person is going to be? I mean, it's just a stupid premise. So you can't
own any of it, or because you'll make money off of it. Yet Pelosi and all those people say, "Oh yeah, we're going to buy stocks that we know the inside trader on." And
we just left a committee meeting, and we know that Halliburton's going to benefit from this action. So we're just going to load up on Halliburton and then let it rip. And meanwhile, you know, I don't know, whatever, man. They're going to go after people, and it's just getting dumber and dumber. So their premise sucks, and they're barking over after the wrong tree. So move on. Like, the New York Times is, I'm done with them as well.
All right, well, what else did I miss?
Dude, I think we covered everything. I've got all check marks on my notes, and then I got some notes of stuff that you talked about that wasn't on my radar. So this was a pretty thorough week's recap on what went down in the Bitcoin and crypto.
There's a lot, that's for sure. So even though the price has not been fantastic, there's still a lot of good things happening, and fingers crossed that this is just temporary from a price perspective and things continue to go up, and it'd be great to have a Santa Claus rally into the end of the year, see some new higher prices. But either way, I think long-term we're still going to be good.
Yep. Agreed.
Awesome. We'll talk again next week. Thanks, Al.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jay.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.